Welcome to the People's Historians Podcast with the Zen Education Project, coordinated by Teaching for Change and Rethinking Schools. In this episode from our series on Teach the Black Freedom Struggle, our host, historian Jean Theo Harris, speaks with historian Matt Delmont about his book, Half American, The Epic Story of African Americans Fighting World War II at Home and Abroad, which tells the stories of how Black people fought racism at home and abroad during World War II. Thanks to Delmont's generosity, every teacher who attended the Teach the Black Freedom Struggle class received a copy of the book. So let's jump in. Join me in welcoming Jean Theo Harris, who will conduct the interview this evening. Jean is a distinguished professor of political science at Brooklyn College and author of The Rebellious Life of Mrs. Rosa Parks, among other of my favorite books. And she's also the co-founder and curator of this series. Really glad that Jean could come in and help with this session today. And our guest historian, Matt Delmont, is Associate Dean of International Studies and Interdisciplinary Programs at the Sherman Fairchild Distinguished Professor of History at Dartmouth College. Delmont is the author of four books. His newest book, Half American, The Epic Story of African Americans Fighting World War II at Home and Abroad, was published in October. Welcome to you both. Thank you for being with us. I'll turn it over to you, Jean.
Well, thank you. Thank you, Jesse. And it's so wonderful to be here. We're 2.5 years into this series, and it continues to amaze me that we get to be together and learn together. And so thank you everyone for making time. Again, this is the part of the semester where things start to get hard and it's easy to not want to come on a Monday night or a Monday afternoon. And so thank you for being with us. And I'm so delighted to get to be in conversation with Matt Delmont. Matt and I have been friends and colleagues, and we've edited and written things together. And so it's so fun to be here to talk about this new book. Everyone knows this. So this is Matt's new book. And everyone who came tonight, because Matt had research funds last year that he did not use, and he decided to use those research funds to make it possible for teachers to have this book. So that's pretty incredible. And it will obviously really change how we all teach this history. So thank you, Matt, for being here. Thank you for that incredible generosity. Welcome.
Thanks, Jean. It's such a great pleasure to have a chance to talk with you about the book. For folks who are on the call, Jean is one of my favorite historians in the whole world, in the whole profession, and is a good friend. And so it's a real pleasure to have a chance to talk about the book with her. And I want to thank Deborah and Jesse and everyone with the Zen Education Project for all the work they've done to organize this and to help support getting the book out into the hands of teachers, to see teachers post receiving their copies of the book in their classrooms and knowing everything that those teachers and librarians are going to be doing with the book is, you couldn't ask for more as a historian. So I'm just thrilled to have a chance to talk with this group tonight and look forward to the conversation and questions.
So where I want to start is actually where this book started, which was actually your previous project. And you can tell us a little bit about it. It was called Black Quotidian. And for over a year, Matt is one of the most disciplined scholars I know. And so every day for over a year, he would post a piece from the Black press from that day in history, or he would get his students to do it. And it became this incredible pedagogical lesson as well. But it was a way to kind of look at the expanse of Black life, of Black history, of Black struggle. But certainly I remember one of the things that comes out of that project is this project, which is that as you are combing through all of these articles, one of the, I feel like, biggest revelations you told me was sort of how you come upon the history of World War II. So maybe you can tell us a little bit both about Black Quotidian, but also how that becomes the genesis for this.
Yeah, thanks for starting there, Jean. So if you went online and searched for blackquotidian.org, it ended up being a publicly available book, open access book, published by Stanford University Press. And it really emerged from my own kind of curiosity and frustrations as a teacher. I was teaching African American history and felt like a lot of the examples I was giving, while they're really important, they felt repetitive in some ways. I mean, I'd talk about Ida B. Wells, I'd talk about the lynching of Emmett Till, talk about the organizing around that. But I didn't feel like I was doing justice to the full range of Black experiences. And I felt like I was using a lot of the same examples year in and year out. And so as a way to try to explore different pathways and really kind of learn new things myself, I started going through these historical African-American newspapers. So I'd just pick a paper from 1935 or 1942 and just see what people were reading about in Cleveland or Pittsburgh or Chicago. And it really did become the foundation for this project on World War II. Because when I got to these papers from 41, 42, 43, I kept coming across examples of Black men and women who volunteered or were drafted into the military. These weren't famous people at all. These were just average, everyday folks. And they were profiled in Black newspapers. They would have a little snapshot photo or a brief write-up that so-and-so got drafted from Cleveland, or this person got drafted from Los Angeles. Seeing hundreds and hundreds of those examples was eye-opening for me, because it was not the kind of everyday material about Black life during the war that I'd ever encountered before in textbooks or in the other materials I was using in my class. And so it made me curious, and it's actually what really kind of sparked my interest in, you know, what more is there to understand about the African-American experience during World War II. And it really did launch me on the research process for that became this book.
Thank you. So I want to start big, and you know, and most of the people on this call know that, like, one of the kind of persistent questions in my research are kind of the myths we have about history, the misuses of history. And I think, just like many people in this space, we've spent a lot of time talking about the myths of the civil rights and Black power movements. I think there are a lot of myths and ways we think about World War II that are really both misapprehensions of that history and really misuses of that history. And so I wondered if you could tell us maybe two or three ways we teach and learn World War II wrong, and, you know, kind of what are the stakes of that wrong history, and kind of what changes when we see a different, you know, see it differently?
Yeah, it's a great question. The two that come to mind first for me are the idea that somehow America was more unified as a nation during World War II. I think it's one of the common misconceptions that we often have when we talk about the World War II era, is that somehow the country came together, put differences aside to fight a common enemy, to win this war against Japan and Germany, the Axis powers. When you actually look at the historical evidence, we know that's not true, that there were deep, deep divisions across many components of American society, but particularly in terms of race. That during the war, obviously, Jim Crow segregation, racial apartheid, was still the order of the day across the U.S. South. And there were other forms of racial discrimination that very much resembled the kind of Southern form of discrimination happening all across the country, in New York, Chicago, Los Angeles. Black people could look around and understand that they were not living in a country that treated them as equals. That was not a surprise to any Black American during the war. And it came through very clearly in Black newspapers at the time. In 1943 alone, there are more than 240 race riots or racial clashes all across the country, in small towns and big cities and on military bases. And so this idea that somehow World War II was a time of national unity, that everyone came together to fight a common cause, to fight to win the war, it just isn't true. And I think the damage it does for us today, if we look back and think that World War II is somehow a simpler time or a more peaceful, unified time, it makes it seem like protests around racial justice today are somehow surprising, or they've come out of thin air, they've come from nowhere. If you tell the actual history about what happened in World War II, it's clear that these battles have been going on for generations. That part of the urgency of the Black Lives Matter movement in the past decade is that people's grandparents were fighting these same battles in these same streets for decades and decades, going back to World War II and earlier. And the other big myth I would say, I hope the book helps to put in different contexts, is the idea of the greatest generation. And if you actually go back and look at Tom Brokaw's book that helped to popularize that phrase, it's actually a much more complicated, nuanced book than I think that shorthand Greatest Generation has become. He does talk about Black veterans. He talks about Japanese Americans who were interned. But that shorthand of the Greatest Generation almost becomes like a shield that's made it impossible to say anything critical about that entire generation of Americans. It's particularly troubling because Black veterans who fought in World War II had a very, very different experience than white veterans did. And so I'm largely ambivalent about whether we should even maintain the idea of the Greatest Generation, but I think for better or worse, I think that term is with us. And I think my approach to it is to foreground the experiences of Black veterans from that same generation, because they were not only fighting that same military battle to defeat the Nazis, but they came home and then fought for civil rights at home. And I think if we foreground those experiences, we can see that too many white Americans of that generation, the so-called Greatest Generation, were too ready to condone and maintain white supremacy at home. They condoned Jim Crow segregation, they condoned all forms of, many forms of racial discrimination that were, that had serious long-term negative consequences for Black Americans and other people of color in the United States. And so I hope that by foregrounding it and putting the focus on the experience of Black veterans and Black Americans during World War II, we can come away with a much clearer sense of really how fraught that time period was in our nation's history.
I mean, this is actually not a question I said I was going to ask you, but one of the things that I've been struggling with during COVID is that it's made me feel like we have to go back and rethink the Greatest Generation, because there's also this idea that, like, in that myth that you're talking about of how unified we are, there's a myth about how everybody's sacrificing for everybody else. And I was wondering if you could maybe talk about that a little bit vis-a-vis, you know, because I think the part of the myth of the Greatest Generation is just this idea of the country putting the country first. And it seems, I mean, part of what you're, I think, doing in this book is saying, well, a lot of people, what their idea of the country or what they were going to put first was very racialized. And in fact, much more like we weren't just sacrificing and like buying war bonds and not eating meat just for everybody. And so I guess I wanted you to tease that out a little bit more.
Yeah, I think like with most historical myths, there are serious grains of truth that underlie the myth, right? And so it is the case that Americans, white Americans, sacrificed a great deal during the war. The rationing was true. The buying of war bonds was true. The fact that so many American citizens got drafted into the military and then fought and gave their lives to help defeat the Nazis, that was an important battle that had to be fought, right? So I think those elements are all true. I think that what changes though, when you foreground issues of race and racism, is that there was a limit to how much people were willing to sacrifice. And they drew those lines in very strange ways, or maybe not strange, in ways that end up producing some very negative outcomes for Black Americans and other people of color. One of my favorite quotes from the book is Roy Wilkins, who is one of the leaders of the NAACP. And he said, "White folks would rather lose this war than give up the luxury of race prejudice." And I think the truth of that is revealed in the fact that the entire military was segregated during the war. Segregation made no sense from a strategic or tactical perspective. It was overly complicated and took a huge amount of resources to make sure everything in the military was segregated. They had to do segregated latrines and barracks and recreation facilities. It was onerous and time consuming and absurd when you actually got down to the practical reality that it was someone's job to make sure that everything was segregated throughout the war. In terms of the defense industries at home, there were a number of hate strikes that were carried out by white workers all over the country. These were strikes that were not authorized by unions, but white workers chose to stop working in these defense industries rather than allow Black workers to join the workforce. And these were 2 to 12 Black workers who got hired. Or in Baltimore, they refused to work because they integrated the bathrooms. And so at a time when theoretically America is banding together to sacrifice everything for the war effort, you had war plants that were making trucks and ammunition and tanks grind to a halt for weeks at a time because white people couldn't use the same bathroom as Black people. It's those details that I think give the lie to the sense that somehow America was giving everything to the war effort. If America was truly giving everything to the war effort, they would have desegregated the military as soon as the United States entered the war. Right? They would have desegregated the defense industries because that was the best way to take advantage of the tremendous capacities of Black Americans and people of color that they had to give to the war effort. the military turned away Black Americans with PhDs from Harvard. They took people who had advanced language training, other skills, and made them cooks rather than taking advantage of the skills they had to deploy in the military effort. And so there are countless examples like this that I think really reveal that idea of sacrifice. It was true in some cases, but as soon as it ran up against a willingness to change anything with regards to racial hierarchies and the racial status quo, that was the breaking point for the majority of white Americans at the time.
Part of, I think, what the book shows is also that the very timeline of World War II looks different when we sort of center the Black experience. And so, and again, as you know, this call is mostly educators, right? How do we teach the timeline of World War II differently if we kind of begin or center the experiences of Black Americans and the viewpoints of Black Americans?
So we have to start by teaching the start of World War II before Pearl Harbor in 1941. If you looked at a Black newspaper from the 1930s, you would see extensive coverage about the rise of fascism in Europe. In 1933, 34, 35, there were dozens and dozens of articles and editorials describing in some amount of detail what was going on in Nazi Germany and how Adolf Hitler rose to power and how he was explicitly pointing to American racial policies to help justify his treatment of Jews in Europe. Even more specifically, Black newspapers are making connections between the kind of treatment of Jewish people in Europe, the segregation on train cars, the theft of property, the physical violence, and what's going on in the Jim Crow South at the same time. And so already by the 1930s, there are explicit claims to be made that the Second World War has started because they see the rise of fascism in Europe. When Italy invades Ethiopia in 1935, that is like a lightning bolt across Black America because Ethiopia is the only independent African nation at the time. So it figures very prominently in the imaginations of a lot of Black Americans. The fact that, again, a fascist regime in Benito Mussolini's Italy invades Ethiopia and that the world community largely does nothing about it is shocking. And again, the headlines say the Second World War has started. A couple years later with the Spanish Civil War, when General Franco's fascist forces stage a military coup against the democratically elected government of Spain, there are more than 80 Black volunteers who go to fight in the Spanish Civil War. And that gets covered in Black newspapers all across the country. And so in that decade before Pearl Harbor, for everyday Black Americans all across the country, they've seen article after article, they've been in conversations, they've heard on the radio that the war has already broken out in Europe and it has serious consequences for the United States, even if the United States hasn't officially entered the war militarily yet. And then on the other side, we have to teach the war as not ending in 1945, that yes, the military battles end, Germany and Japan surrender, but that whole generation of Black veterans comes home and starts fighting for civil rights, that they would never say that the war ended in 1945 because for them, a different battlefield in the war just continued. And so foregrounding the experience of Black Americans really troubles this idea that the war can be neatly bounded from 1941 to 1945. That's really just the American military conflict piece. The broader social implications of fighting for freedom and democracy, both in the United States but globally, really push the boundaries of that timeline in two different directions.
Just in terms of the beginning and the what you were saying about the Black press, like how is the Black press, I mean, if you were reading like the Amsterdam News and the New York Times or the Eagle and the Sentinel and then the LA, you know, are you getting more coverage, for instance, of Nazism in the Black press than you are in the, you know, in the 30s than in the mainstream white press? Is just to sort of push, to kind of clarify and push your point a little, like, how does it compare?
You're getting much more clearly worded and clearly argued coverage in the Black press than you see in a lot of the white press. The project I would recommend for folks, if they're not familiar with it, the US Holocaust Museum and Memorial has a project they've done called History Unfolded that's gathered newspaper articles from people all across the country of how American newspapers were covering the Holocaust as it unfolded. And so I wouldn't want to say that mainstream white newspapers didn't cover events in Europe, but they didn't cover it with the same amount of moral clarity as Black newspapers did. I think that's the thing that Black newspapers brought to bear much earlier than white newspapers did. Again, because they recognized that what Hitler was doing had a model, and it had a model that was going to have terrible, terrible consequences, not just in Europe and not just for Jews as the primary targets of it. It was going to have very terrible consequences for the world because they see how it's already happening in the United States and in the South particularly. And so the frequency of the coverage and the moral clarity of the coverage is much, much sharper in the black press than it was in a mainstream white paper.
Right. I mean, mostly tonight we're going to be sort of focusing on sort of the African-American experience sort of during the war at home, sort of before, during, and after the military conflict. And people need to read Matt's book to sort of get more of what's happening in Europe and the kind of the battlefield side of it. But I wanted to ask one question, which is where the book starts, literally, which is with the Lincoln Brigades, and both why you started there and kind of what that shows us, like why did people join? But also kind of the criminalization of the Lincoln Brigades and like what, I mean, it's another moment where sort of a different view into the whole era, right? If they had been treated differently. So just, could you give us a little bit about sort of why you start there and what the Lincoln Brigades were and
what they did? Yeah, so for people who aren't familiar, the Lincoln Brigades were a group of American volunteers who went to fight in the Spanish Civil War. There were thousands of volunteers from all over the world who joined the side of the Republican forces to fight against fascism in the Spanish Civil War. And the Lincoln Brigades were about just more than 3,000 Americans who fought in that. Of those, more than 80 were Black Americans. Langston Hughes, the famous poet, becomes a war correspondent for the Baltimore African-American because he's fascinated by this idea that Black Americans from New York, from Alabama, from Georgia would uproot themselves and travel to a country they'd never been to before to fight in a civil war. And it literally mean fight. This was frontline combat that they were taking on. They were risking their lives, and many of them lost their lives fighting in this conflict. Hughes goes over there and reports on some of the people who are fighting, and a couple of them that stand out that I can share are, there's a woman named Celaria Key, who was originally from Akron, Ohio, but she trained as a nurse at Harlem Hospital. She becomes concerned about what's going on in Europe, first with the Italian invasion of Ethiopia, and then she works with a number of Jewish doctors who tell her about what's going on in Germany and how Hitler is treating Jewish people in Germany. She tries to volunteer for the Red Cross, but they turn her away because of the color of their skin. They say she'd be too much trouble to make space for her in the Red Cross. And so she becomes the only Black nurse to be part of the Lincoln Brigades, and she's there tending to soldiers who are coming back from the front lines. She goes on to serve as a nurse in the US Army during World War II, and she's one of the people that Hughes writes about. Another one that really captured Hughes' attention was a guy named Walter Garland, who was from Brooklyn, New York, and he was an officer in the Lincoln Brigades. And so part of the reason the Lincoln Brigades figured so powerfully for a lot of Black Americans, because at that time, the US Army is segregated, and they're not allowing Black men to participate in combat. They're put in these more menial roles behind the scenes. Garland, in contrast, was an officer in the Lincoln Brigades, and he's leading an integrated unit where he's got American troops, English troops, Irish, Jewish, Cuban, Mexican. It's almost like a United Nations unit that's under his command. And when Hughes travels over there, he gets to see Garland giving the commands and marching his unit in a parade formation through town. And it captures his imagination because it's a Black American leading this integrated unit, an integrated combat unit, in a way that just wasn't possible in the United States. A number of those Lincoln volunteers, both Black and white, go on to serve during World War II, including one named Edward Allen Carter, who wins the Medal of Honor posthumously, sported. But as you noted, Gene, the politics that led a number of these volunteers to Europe were leftist, and that was of extreme concern to a lot of American politicians. And so rather than celebrating the bravery or courage of these volunteers who go and risk their lives to fight against fascism in Spain, when they come home, they're harassed by the FBI and are tracked and surveilled because their political positions are deemed too controversial in the US at the time. And so it's a important place to start because it shows that Black Americans were among the first to literally take up arms to fight against fascism. And it gives a kind of clear model of what was possible in terms of American military participation that wasn't yet welcome within the American armed forces.
Just sticking up still with this sort of the earlier timeline, I wanted us to talk a little bit about the March on Washington movement. And then in many ways, part of the story of this early period is the story of World War II and the ways that the United States initially gets out of the Great Depression, right? By becoming, in some ways, the industrial engine for the Allies, right? And just supplying. And Black Americans both recognize what's happening, but also recognize the real dangers that Black Americans are gonna get left out of this, you know, this industrial kind of resurgence that's happening in the United States. And A. Philip Randolph and, you know, many people we will see again later, right, in the 60s are at the forefront of basically, you tell us, right? What do they see as kind of the danger or the threat, and what do they do? And in many ways, how is this really the beginning of the kind of modern civil rights movement?
So in the lead up to World War II, before the United States officially enters after Pearl Harbor, President Roosevelt announces that America is going to be the arsenal of democracy, that it's going to provide all of these supplies that the Allies are going to need to fight and win the war. And what that means, everyone understands, is that it's going to mean jobs, right? That this means that the defense industries are going to be created all over the country, that factories are going to transfer from whatever they made previously to starting to make ammunition and tanks and trucks, all these goods that the Allies are going to need. If things were left untouched, Black Americans were going to get locked out of that great boon of jobs. It would almost all go based on how the unions were structured and how prejudice was happening within these factories and defense industries. They're going to get locked out of this huge windfall of resources and jobs. A. Philip Randolph was the leader of the largest Black union in the country, the Brotherhood of Sleeping Car Porters. And in early 1941, he announces a march on Washington. He says, unless President Roosevelt agrees to make sure that there's not discrimination in the defense industries, he's going to lead 100,000 Black Americans in a march on Washington. And what's so remarkable about that when he announces it is that it's shocking to both white politicians, but also to a lot of Black Americans. The idea that you could bring together that many people, self-organized among only Black Americans, to demonstrate their political power and to embarrass the White House in that way was a threat that hadn't ever been made at that scale before. Between the time when Randolph makes the claim in about March of 1941 and the summer of 1941, it receives a huge amount of coverage in Black newspapers. He's traveling around the country and he's working with organizers who do all of the groundwork to create these March on Washington chapters in all different parts of the country. And that's where a lot of the actual power comes from, that it's not just him standing on a soapbox saying, I'm going to make this happen, but he can point to people on the ground who are doing the organizing who say that they're going to be able to turn out 1,000 people from Oakland, 2,000 people from Houston, who are all going to make this trip to Washington, D.C. Eventually, Randolph gets into the White House, has a sit-down negotiation with President Roosevelt, and initially, Roosevelt isn't willing to do anything. He says, you know, if I give this to you, everyone's going to come in here and demand something. But through a kind of high-stakes negotiation, Randolph's able to eventually persuade Roosevelt to sign an executive order that, at least on paper, has non-discrimination provisions in defense industries in exchange for Randolph calling off that march on Washington. The reason it's important in our broader understanding of Black freedom struggles, though, is that it really creates some of the early infrastructure for organizing, that these March on Washington chapters, they don't go away. They're there and they take on different shapes. And a lot of those organizers and activists have long lives in Black freedom struggles. I think Bayard Rustin, among the most important and most famous, that literally provides the infrastructure and the architecture for the March on Washington in 1963. The other reason I think it's important is that it was a tremendous display of political imagination, right? For Randolph to threaten and to be able to threaten it persuasively that he was going to lead this massive March on Washington, it entirely changed the dynamic of how Black activists engaged with politicians in Washington, D.C., that even though he never had to actually carry out the march, just the fact that he could persuasively argue that he was going to do it added a new type of leverage that Black activists just hadn't had previously.
Right. I mean, I think two questions there. One, I think, could you say a little more? I mean, because I think part of that is also the way that it expands what's possible, right? That like all of a sudden you've seen the president bow to a movement, right? And so how is that going to shape this next, you know, 20, 30 years of what is possible to imagine, of what is possible to ask for? And I guess my second question is also that this is also a contested moment, right? That Randolph takes a deal that Rustin doesn't agree with, right? So that this unity is not even a unity, you know, like there's so many ways that this history is more complicated than we get. So you could go in either or both of those directions.
Yeah, maybe on the second part first. I mean, it's a great point, right? For everything that Randolph and those other leaders accomplish with that, it ends up being something of a hollow victory. At the start of that call for the March of Washington, they're also calling for the desegregation of the military, which obviously doesn't happen until 1948 with an executive order from President Truman. But even the executive order that Roosevelt signs, Executive Order 8802, initially it's greeted with great fanfare in the Black press and by a lot of Black leaders. It's described as the second Emancipation Proclamation by some folks. But when it actually tries to get implemented, the commission that's put in place to try to investigate these claims of discrimination, it was an organization called the Fair Employment Practices Commission, the FEPC. They don't have anywhere near the resources or manpower to be able to investigate the thousands and thousands of claims of discrimination that are coming up after this executive order is signed. And so it's a case where on paper, it looks like it's going to do great things, but then the reality is it doesn't produce as many results as was hoped. And it requires Black activists and organizations all across the country to continue to protest at their local factories to actually get some of the jobs that are meant to be promised there. And so I think it is a good example that anytime you have these kind of high stakes negotiations, there's something that's lost, right? There's a question about how much can you get at any point in time? And then that gap between the words on paper and the actuality of what can be implemented is often quite vast. On the first piece, I think it did help to demonstrate what a large group of Black Americans with powerful leadership could get from the White House or get from other political figures. It's in many ways set the model for the kind of negotiations King and others had with the Kennedy administration.
Where I wanted to start next was sort of now getting us into World War II and this idea of the double V and sort of what was it and, you know, I mean, why do Black soldiers wear, you know, have tattoos of the double V, right? How it becomes also similarly like surveilled, right? Just tell us about the campaign itself and its significance.
Yeah, so the title of the book is actually taken from a letter that helps to launch the Double Victory campaign, which is written by a guy named James Thompson, who's a 26-year-old from Wichita, Kansas. And he writes this letter to the Pittsburgh Courier, which was one of the largest and most influential Black newspapers. He's writing in late December 1941 after the bombing of Pearl Harbor, because he knows that he and other Black Americans are about to get drafted into a segregated military. And so he writes this really powerful, probing letter, in which he asks a series of questions, including, he says, should I sacrifice my life to live half American? Is the America I know worth defending? And that phrase, should I sacrifice my life to live half American? It just really stuck with me for the 7 years I was working on this book. And it's why I chose Half American as the title. What Thompson was asking was a really powerful question because he recognizes he's gonna get drafted into a segregated military and potentially be asked to fight for and maybe even die for a country that doesn't yet treat him as a full citizen. The Courier uses Thompson's letter to launch the Double Victory campaign, which becomes the rallying cry for Black Americans during the war, that they're fighting for both victory over fascism abroad, but also victory over racism at home. And, you know, it's one of those things I've taught about for more than a decade in my classes, but when I actually paused and like really spent time thinking about that idea of a truly double victory, it's a really powerful framing for how Black Americans thought about the war, because they meant both parts of it sincerely. This victory over fascism abroad, I think, is powerful because Black Americans, much more so than white Americans, understood what fascism was about. That one of the kind of fascinating things until I got into the research for this, I didn't really understand that other than Jewish Americans and Black Americans, a lot of everyday white Americans didn't really have a clear sense of why America was even fighting the war. They said as much in the public polling. They wanted revenge against Japan, but the question of like why they're fighting in Europe, a lot of white Americans just kind of threw up their hands and said, I don't know. Like, we don't know what what is leading us there. So that desire to have victory over fascism abroad, Black Americans really meant it because they understood what a dire threat fascism was. But I think importantly, linking that to victory over racism at home, I think that's where we see that the war didn't end and couldn't end just on the military battlefields, because it didn't do much good to defeat Nazism abroad if you had to come home and face almost the exact same version of white supremacy at home. And so that's why Black veterans were so dedicated to fighting for civil rights here on the home front. One of the things that I try to argue in the book is that if we take the Double Victory campaign seriously, it becomes pretty apparent that for a lot of white Americans, they were really only fighting a single victory campaign. They wanted a military victory and then a return to the status quo. They wanted America as it was before the start of the war. And that was really the exact opposite of what Black Americans wanted. They didn't want to return to a country that treated them as half American. And that's where you can see a lot of the tensions that emerge after the war. Is there are two very different ideas about what the war is about and what vision of America should come to fruition after the war.
Right, I mean, so we could really talk about how the United, like, we don't win the war, right? Because it's like we only win half the war, right? I mean, I think we all grew up and it's like, well, first, like, we, you know, there's the European front and then there's the Pacific front, but that, like, there's also just the US front that, like, we don't actually win, right? And Mark Levy in the chat wants to know a little bit more about how people return, vets and other war workers return, and what they do to kind of engage in kind of civil rights and freedom struggles in the 40s and 50s.
So both on the home front and for the veterans who are returning, a lot of that organizing takes place during the war years. So some of the figures who become more prominent in the 1950s and 60s, people like Ella Baker, really play important roles forming some of the infrastructure for civil rights during the war. During the war, Ella Baker is the head of branch organizing for the NAACP. So she's traveling all across the country, organizing different local communities to form their own NAACP branches and to sign up new members. And she's tremendously successful. The number of members and branches increases dramatically over the course of the war. One thing that's important about Ella Baker in this story, and why I was so excited to include her in alongside military history, is that her vision of leadership was really a direct counter to how the military thought about leadership. That Ella Baker believed that Black Americans from all walks of life had the capacity to be leaders, that you didn't just need to be a doctor or a lawyer or a professional class person, that sharecroppers, everyday Black folks who'd be at the barbershops and beauty parlors and churches, they could be leaders, and they were leaders. She's doing that at the exact same time that the military is saying Black Americans, no matter what their education is, really can't be officers. They don't have the capacity to be leaders. She's showing the lie to that statement. Some of my favorite sources that I found in doing research, and these are in Ella Baker's papers at the Schomburg, were part of that Double Victory campaign. Maybe the clearest illustration of it was that some of the new members who signed up for the NAACP were actually active duty servicemen and women who are in Europe or in the Pacific. And they're essentially passing the hat around or passing the helmet around to raise money for civil rights battles at home while they're stationed in Normandy or in islands in the Pacific. And it's such a pure illustration of how the home front battles and the military battles were always intertwined for these Black men and women. In terms of what happens after the war, for a lot of the defense industry workers, they lose their jobs because it's the first, last hired, first fired kind of policies. But the Black veterans who come back, they become leaders in civil rights organizations all across the country. And a lot of them credit the kind of training they received in the military to help in terms of helping them organize, both the sense of how to use firearms, the sense of bravery in the face of people who would be using firearms against you, and then just the kind of very basic logistical aspects of what it means to organize dozens and dozens of people towards a common goal.
Right. I mean, we can't ever have a conversation without talking about Rosa Parks, but obviously Rosa Parks is NAACP. History starts during World War II because of World War II, right? That it's her brother serving in the Pacific, she can't register to vote, then she goes to one of these Ella Baker sort of organizing and is really activated. So, but that there's no way to understand her decision that to go to the Montgomery NAACP separate from this kind of contradiction of her brother serving and risking his life, and Ben just not being able to vote at home and not having a kind of, you know, any type of full citizenship at home.
Yeah. And yeah. Dean, if I can, one of the examples I cite from your book on Rosa Parks is that the anecdote about how on the base in Montgomery, the Maxwell Air Base, because it's later in the war, they've desegregated the buses on that base. And so she's able to ride in any part of the bus she chooses. When they get to the edge of the base, then has to transfer into City Montgomery, she has to sit in the back of the bus. And I think the way you framed it is that she described it as having to go from first class citizenship, which she can sit wherever she wants, to second class citizenship when she has to go to the back of the bus, just in the course of one city block.
Right. And the, I mean, if, and talking about imagination, right, both what how one's imagination changes, because it's like, oh, wait, I can sit here next to my friend, talking to my friend, right? Because part of it is like, she's working with a white woman there, and she's, you know, they're riding the bus. And then this, so, I mean, she talks about her imagination changing, and then that, like, being, like, physically segregated. This was a question I was going to ask you in the breakout, like when we were having the breakout groups, that my students always then want to know, why do Black people serve and want to serve so much? And I think, and, you know, I teach at Brooklyn College, and it's a, you know, it's like quarter Black, quarter Latino, quarter Asian American, quarter white, right? And we always have to, like, and they're just like, it doesn't make sense. And so maybe you can talk to us about, like, that, why, even in the midst of this half Americanness or second class citizenship, why Black Americans push a lot of barriers to be able to serve.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, going back to that quote from James Thompson, the, should I sacrifice my life to live half American? Is the America I know worth defending? Black Americans answer that question in hundreds of different ways. And so there were a number of Black Americans who didn't accept their draft status. I think one of the realities is once the draft happens, Black people and other Americans have a choice. Either they can accept their draft status and serve, or they can risk going to jail. It's not unlike the choices that people encountered during Vietnam. And there were thousands of Black Americans who chose jail over military service. I think most famously, Bayard Rustin, who's a Quaker and a pacifist. He was opposed to all wars, but he was also opposed to the fighting for the United States, given what he understood about the racial policies and treatment of Black people in the United States. He was opposed to fighting for the United States. He serves 3 years in a federal penitentiary rather than serving during World War II. There are examples of college students from Morehouse and Howard who declined their draft status and became almost local heroes among their peers, even as their peers are going off to fight the war. And so I certainly wouldn't want to give the impression that everyone, that all Black Americans accepted their draft status and went to fight the war, but there are thousands who resisted it. I think for other Black Americans, though, one of the reasons there's a desire to fight for the opportunity to serve in the military is that it means jobs, that there was payment that went along with military service. There was training that went along with military service, and the military was taxpayer funded. And so one of the things that activists kept saying was that it makes no sense for us to not be able to partake in the benefits that are going to come from this military service if we're paying into it as taxpayers. For some number of people, there was a sense of patriotism. They wanted to fight for their country, not unlike how a lot of white Americans wanted to fight for their country, even while always understanding that America had sort of deeply entrenched racist policies. And then I think for some number of people also, they had come from families where military service had been a tradition, and recognized that military service had often been linked with American identity and claims to American citizenship. And I think that motivated some Black Americans to volunteer as well. But I think the reality is once the draft starts, it's very, very hard to fight back against that. And that's why more than a million Black Americans end up serving during World War II.
Just, I mean, again, since this is a community of educators, if you were going to pick a primary source to sort of teach this history of the double V and of kind of the Black experience sort of during the classic period of World War II, what primary sources might you use?
Yeah, and some of the ones that come to mind first are almost bookended. So I think that Thompson letter that I've mentioned, I'll share all these with Deborah and the Zinn Education Project folks afterwards, but that Thompson letter that launches the Double Victory campaign, and because it's such a powerful rhetorical device, the should I sacrifice my life to the path of America? Like, that question is just as powerful today as I think it was in 1941. And then some of the sources I didn't know about until I got into the project were the reporting of war correspondents. So not just Lengths and Hughes for the Baltimore African American, but later in the war, there are people like Trez Van Anderson and Roy Otley, Dan Burley, who write for Black newspapers, who are embedded with these Black units who are in the Pacific Theater and the European Theater. Near the end of the war in 1945, they write these really powerful stories that both describe the vital and often unsung work that Black troops are doing to help win the war, but also how those Black troops are already being written out of the history of World War II, even as the war is ending. And I think that's a point that really can't be stated clearly enough, that Black Americans at the time understood what was happening. They understood that they had served a country that didn't respect their service. They understood that they returned to a country and were discriminated against and were attacked and in some cases killed as veterans, largely because of their service. They understood that they were being discriminated against by the GI Bill, right? That those articles are in Black newspapers in 1945, 46, 47. It's not just something that historians or sociologists discovered in the last 10 or 15 years. And they understand that white historians and other popular media outlets are intentionally writing Black servicemen and women out of the history of World War II. So just after the war, Life magazine, Collier's magazine published these thick volumes with thousands of pictures from World War II. They include only one image of a Black soldier. Right? This is deeply upsetting to both Black veterans, but also to the Black journalists who covered them, who were on the ground and saw everything that Black troops did to help win the war. And to read these journalists talking about it in 1945, 1946, as America is celebrating the supposed victory in the war, they're recognizing that Black Americans aren't getting their due in helping to earn that victory, but also are already being written out of the history. And I think it's a powerful statement of how history is written and how people were alive to these injustices as they were transpiring.
Right, right. I want us to talk a tiny bit more about the GI Bill, because I think part of how you're changing the timeline is not just that people return fighting, right? But that there's this whole next chapter of both the ways that the war changes sort of life, both for white and Black Americans, and that in many ways, the GI Bill is both arguably one of the most successful pieces of social legislation in the history of this country, and also one of the most discriminatory or leads to one of the greatest sort of racial gaps. And so could you tell us about that and I think we all think we know what the GI Bill is, but I think if you could kind of flesh that out for us.
Sure. And in the chat, I dropped a link to an article that came out about a month ago from Mother Jones that draws on some of the material from the book, but actually says a lot more about the GI Bill. And so I would point people there as well to get a fuller view of this. So the GI Bill is perhaps one of the most important pieces of legislation in the 20th century. It's what enabled a whole generation of white veterans to be able to enter the middle class. It provided access to low interest mortgages that were backed by the VA, provided access to college tuition, provided access to job training, small business loans, health benefits, a whole host of resources on the order of billions and billions of dollars that helped to essentially reward veterans for their service during the war and helped to reintegrate them into American society. And it was wildly successful for white veterans. It's what enabled them to move into middle class and then enabled them to accrue resources that they could then pass on to their families. The problem is that as that legislation is being written, some of the key politicians who control these committees, control the veterans committees, were white segregationist senators. It's important to understand that these politicians were not democratically elected. They came from states where Black people couldn't really register to vote because of decades of violence and intentional discrimination, things like the poll taxes. But they're in Washington, D.C., representing states like Mississippi, Georgia, Alabama, and they've been in D.C. for a long time, so they have seniority on these committees. What they do when they craft this legislation is they make sure the benefits are going to be distributed at the state level and the local level rather than at the federal level. If it had been done at the federal level, there's at least a chance that the government could have enforced some sort of non-discrimination provisions. But everyone at the time understands if you do things at the state's level, that means you're deferring to the whatever policies and prejudices exist at the state level, right? And again, this is something that comes through clearly at the time. Everyone knows what's up, so to speak, when you're talking about the state level. And that's what comes to pass, that when Black veterans go to their local veterans branches, try to access these benefits, they're either given the runaround, they're denied outright, or they're pushed into vocational training programs rather than four-year college and universities. To kind of drill down a bit, at the time, thinking about higher education, throughout the South, colleges are still entirely segregated. And so despite Black colleges and universities being incredibly resilient and resourceful, there just aren't enough seats at these Black colleges and universities to accommodate the thousands and thousands of veterans who want to go to college. And so whereas white veterans are able to use their benefits to go to almost any college in the country, Black veterans are really limited in terms of where they can go. Because outside of the South, there are quotas that only allow a handful of Black students to go. In the South, the white colleges aren't allowing any Black students. The Black colleges don't have enough seats to accommodate the Black students. With the mortgage policies, the GI Bill doesn't require any sort of non-discrimination provisions, which means that it just follows the same racial discrimination that had already been in place in the mortgage and banking industries. And so this is a story not just in the South, but in the North as well. In places like New York and New Jersey, Black veterans can't get mortgages to live in almost any neighborhood. And so by 1950, 98% of those mortgages, these VA-backed mortgages, go to white veterans, only 2% to Black veterans. There's an institute at Brandeis University today that's done some calculations. These are economists who've done calculations on the long-term impacts of this. And what they found is that on average, the benefits that were available to Black veterans were only worth about 40% of the benefits that were available to white World War II veterans. And over a lifetime, it was about a $100,000 difference. So when you look at the vast racial wealth gap that's in the country, a huge part of that can be traced back to the GI Bill. And the last point I would make is it's not the case that no Black veterans were able to get GI Bill benefits, that thousands of veterans were able to benefit from the GI Bill. I think what we can learn from that is the veterans who were able to use their GI Bill benefits did amazing, amazing things. There were women like W. Johnson Roundtree, who was in the Women's Army Corps. She uses the GI Bill to go to Howard University Law School and then opens a law firm in Washington, D.C. and wins several important civil rights cases. There was a guy named Robert P. Madison who fought the 92nd Infantry Division, earns a Purple Heart in his service in Europe. He comes back, uses the GI Bill to earn architectural degrees from Case Western and from Harvard, and then goes back to Cleveland, where he's from, and opens a trailblazing architectural firm. And so I think part of the story of the GI Bill is that, yes, there was a huge amount of discrimination that negatively impacted Black veterans, but there's also what we might call an opportunity cost, that if there hadn't been this discrimination, we can see from the people who benefit from it that they did amazing things, that if a wider swath of Black veterans had been able to benefit from it, we would have had a whole nother generation of Black doctors and engineers and architects and teachers that we didn't have because of the discrimination.
Right, and that I think the opportunity gain for white people, I think the ways that the GI Bill makes college like much more in the reach of many more white Americans than, so it erases the fact that most white Americans didn't have access to college before 1940, right? And so that opportunity gain, it's not natural that this happens, you know, similarly, right? Most white Americans don't own their own houses before 1940, right? And so that opportunity gain as well is not just a measure of hard work and the kind of prosperity of the 50s, right? It's this incredible leg up, right? That shows that both a leg up works, right? So this middle class that we, the kind of prosperity of the 50s is in many ways, right, as much about the GI Bill as, you know, as anything, right?
Exactly. It's a massive, massive federal investment that largely benefits white veterans and their families. And as you're saying, it dramatically changes some of the norms in American society, that home ownership was not prevalent prior to World War II. College education was not prevalent prior to World War II across any race. And the fact is that it changed a lot of the norms of what success and middle-class status and access to those resources looked like.
Right. I also wanted to, you mentioned Roundtree, and one of the other things I think your book does, I think most of the time when we think about the greatest generation, it's a picture of men, right? And or it's explicitly about women. It's about Rosie the Riveter, right? And I think your book complicates that because there are women all over the book. So maybe you could talk a little bit about how World War II looks for Black women and from the eyes and experiences of Black women.
Yeah, it's a really important question. In terms of military service, there were thousands of Black women who served in the Women's Army Corps. And a lot of what they described was very similar to what men in the Army, Navy, and Marines described, that they were proud of their service in many ways, but they were discriminated against on these Army bases. There was a story from Women's Army Corps in Des Moines, Iowa, right? I think one of the troubling things is that not only did the military have segregation on these bases in the South, they also had Jim Crow style segregation on bases outside of the South. So in places like Iowa or in California, they transported the norms of the South into these bases elsewhere. One of the things that these women in Iowa described, though, was that they were only allowed to use the swimming pool 1 hour a week for recreation, and then they would drain the swimming pool afterwards, just as a petty way to emphasize their second class status. There were a group of Black Women's Army Corps members at Fort Devens in Massachusetts that staged a protest and risked a court martial to protest their treatment and their assignment to these menial positions at Fort Devens. But the largest group who goes overseas is a group called the 688th Postal Directory Battalion, who's under the leadership of Major Charity Adams. And they're the ones who are responsible for delivering mail all over the European theater, which is actually a really complicated job because you had all these guys named Tom Jones and John Smith, and they're in units that are moving constantly, but they developed systems to be able to distribute the mail, which both Black and white troops after the war say was really essential to morale. And so this postal battalion, I think, is among the Black women who were in the service and who deployed, was among the most important. On the home front, there are more than a million Black Americans who work in the defense industries, and 600,000 of those are Black women. And those were really important factory jobs and important employment opportunities, because primarily before the war, the main work opportunities outside the home for Black women were largely either in agriculture or working in domestic service for white families. And so one of the consistent refrains for these Black Rosie the Riveters was that it was the war that helped to get them out of white women's kitchens. It opened up new employment opportunities for them during the war. It was also the case that they were deeply involved in protests, that whether it was with the NAACP or the March on Washington movement, Black women were key organizers and key participants in these civil rights protests, including getting access to a lot of these defense industry jobs. And then the last piece that I think comes through clearly when you read a lot of the stories, particularly in Black newspapers from the time, that as with any community where you have to send people off to war, the loss of people in those wars had serious impacts on communities and on family members. And so, and for the women who had brothers go to war, fathers go to war, husbands go to war, those stories, those memories came through really powerfully in Black newspapers at the time and then in their recollections afterwards. And so throughout the book, even though when you're talking about, as you're saying, talking about the history of World War II, it's very easy to overemphasize the male aspect, particularly on the military side. I try to make clear throughout that you can't understand this history without understanding the really vital roles Black women played both on the home front and in the war effort.
I guess where I want to end this conversation is actually not with this book. Because this is the Teach the Black Freedom Struggle series, one of my all-time favorite Black Freedom Struggle books is Matt's earlier book, Why Busing Failed. And I just, because we haven't had you here to talk about that book, I kind of wanted to end there just because I think people, just to give people a tiny taste of what that book does. And one of the things I love about the book is that you got your publisher to let you put busing in quotes for the whole book. And so why do you do this? And I think, what are you trying to get us to see about this false frame of busing? Just to give us a taste of this book so people can get that book too.
Thanks, Jean. And I dropped in the chat the companion website for Why Busing Failed. For all my projects, I've tried to create web resources. So if you go to that website, it's open access. You'll find a lot of the primary sources and essentially like a Reader's Digest version of the argument for the book, designed with teaching in mind. So why busing failed, the reason I asked the publisher and put busing in quotes throughout the book was that the framing of how we talk about school desegregation really matters. And one of the arguments I make in the book is that the people who were opposed to school desegregation, who wanted to maintain school segregation across the country, were really successful in framing the terms of the debate. And so that idea of busing, the way it emerges a term of protest in the 1960s and 70s, that was a choice. It was a choice that the media made in terms of how to report on this. It was a choice that, that protesters made in terms of how to protest against what they saw as an unfair disruption to school segregation. It was a choice that, that judges and other political officials made to use that term as a way to understand school segregation. Those debates over busing were fundamentally about the constitutional rights of Black students and Latino students in terms of having access to equal education. But once that that history and that those events got linked to this term busing, it became a conversation about the anger and frustration of white parents. And I think that's a really important historical point to make, that if we talk about busing and only focus on the perspective of the quote-unquote anti-busing protesters, that means you're only focusing on the anger of white parents and protesters. You're not focusing on the history of the Black students, the Puerto Rican students, the Latino students who were trying to get equal education in these schools, in the North, particularly in Pontiac, in Chicago, in Boston, in New York. And I know, Gene, we've had a chance to write on this history together, but it matters deeply. I mean, one of the most surprising things for me as a historian is that the Smithsonian at one point asked me to write a blog post related to some of the materials they had about the Boston busing crisis. And I said, sure, I'd be happy to do it. When they sent me what they had, though, everything they had was from the anti-busing protesters, this group called ROAR, right? Restore Our Alienated Rights, which were white protesters who were protesting efforts to desegregate Boston schools after more than a decade of protests by Black activists. They had nothing from activists like Ruth Batson or Ellen Jackson, who'd been fighting for more than a decade to integrate these schools. And for all of us as educators, it should make us aware that, particularly when we talk about the history of civil rights in the North, there's a tendency to focus on white people as opposed to Black students at the center of the story. If you think about what it means to talk about the history of Little Rock, but not talk about the Little Rock Nine or Daisy Bates, talk about the white mobs as the center of the story, that's a very distorted history. We would know it was wrong if it was happening in Little Rock, but for some reason we've accepted that way of framing the story when it comes to Boston. And so part of what the book tries to do is, again, change the time frame of this story, right? Starting in New York in the 1950s, recognizing people were fighting about this for decades, and then try to give us an understanding of how media shaped and distorted this history.
And I mean, from the chat, we can see that people want you back and we can have a longer conversation about it, because there's so many things that I think for those of us who are teaching about this history, like, we need to know. I mean, for me, one of the biggest revelations when I started to look at Boston, and we've talked about this for years, is that most of the students in Boston are being bused before busing, right? And so we have to put it in quotes, because it's like, well, they are being bused, but busing is a whole different concept, right? So I just wanted to say two things. One, for everyone on the call, we are back next month, and next month, Brian Stevenson is joining us. And then we have a whole roster in the spring. We just put a link in the chat so you can see where we're going. But again, the Teach the Black Freedom Studies series is once a month on Monday nights. And so we've got a lot to look forward to. So please look at the list and come again and again and again. And then I think I wanted to end just by saying both thank you to Matt and this wonderful conversation and making this book available and all of these resources, because I mean, I think always, again, one of the things I admire about you is how much you think about teachers and how much you make your books usable for us as educators. And this is, you know, yet another way that you're doing that. And then finally, thank you to everyone. Again, this is a hard time of the year in an incredibly hard moment to be teachers. And so thank you for just continuing to join us in this community. Have a wonderful evening. Thank you so much.
Thank you for joining us today. This podcast is brought to you by the Zen Education Project, coordinated by Teaching for Change and Rethinking Schools.
Music provided by The Blue Tide, a Seattle-based acoustic blues duo of Daniel Rapport and JD Lenore, aka Jesse Hagopian. You can find them on Spotify, Apple Music, or wherever you get your music.